Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
Former President Donald Trump on January 6th, 2021. As we know, soon after Trump spoke to that crowd, many of them surged on the Capitol, ransacked the building, threatened lawmakers, and attempted to stop the lawful count of electoral votes for the presidency of the United States.
Our democracy was inches from ruin. Our system of government was stretched to the breaking point. Members and staff were terrorized. Police officers fought hand to hand for hours. People lost their lives.
Representative Benny Thompson, chair of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Over the past week, the committee has released information from documents handed over by former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Meadows has since stopped cooperating with the committee. Yesterday, the House voted to recommend that the Department of Justice pursue criminal charges against Meadows for failing to appear before the committee for deposition. But there is disturbing content in the documents Meadows has already provided. A PowerPoint emailed to Meadows that suggests Trump declare, quote, all electronic voting invalid, or declare a national emergency in order to overthrow the election. Then there are dozens of text messages sent to Meadows before, on, and after January 6th. Representative Liz Cheney read some of the messages on Monday.
Quote, POTUS has to come out firmly and tell the protesters to dissipate. Someone is going to get killed. In another, Mark, he needs to stop this now. A third, in all caps, tell them to go home. A fourth, and I quote, POTUS needs to calm this down.
It wasn't just lawmakers frantically texting Meadows on January 6th.
Quote, Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy.
That message was sent by Fox News host Laura Ingraham. She sent the message in the afternoon of January 6th. But that night on her show, The Ingraham Angle, Ingraham deflected responsibility away from Trump.
The Capitol was under siege by people who can only be described as antithetical to the MAGA movement. Now, there were likely not all Trump supporters, and there are some reports that Antifa sympathizers may have been sprinkled throughout the crowd.
The pattern continues. Fox News hosts sent desperate plea after plea to Meadows, begging him to make Trump take action to stop the insurrection. But on television a few hours later, they gamely deflected any responsibility or obligation away from Trump. Here's Representative Cheney reading a text from Fox host Brian Kilmeade.
Please get him on TV, destroying everything you have accomplished.
But on TV later that night, Kilmeade dodged.
The lack of security stunned me. I do not know Trump supporters that have ever demonstrated violence that I know of in a big situation.
Again, the afternoon of January 6th, here's a text from Fox News' Sean Hannity to Meadows.
Quote, can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol.
But on his show that night, Hannity instead lay the responsibility at the feet of an unknown they.
They knew there were hundreds of thousands of people that came to town. We also knew that there's always bad actors that will infiltrate large crowds. I don't care if they're radical left, radical right. I don't know who they are. They're not people I would support.
Well, Brian Kloss, professor of politics at University College London and author of Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. Professor Kloss, welcome to the show. Let me first start by asking you these text messages to Meadows. What part of the January 6th puzzle do they fill in?
Well, I don't think they give us information that many of us didn't suspect, but they make it clear that Fox News hosts who publicly downplayed the insurrection, the violence around the Capitol, were privately aware of how serious it was, privately aware that Trump had the power to stop it, otherwise they wouldn't have texted Meadows, and privately aware that the whole situation had gotten out of hand, despite the fact that they had been encouraging people to rally at the Capitol to try to subvert American democracy and American elections. So I think it just adds a bit of detail into a story that we already were familiar with, that lots of people were cheerleading this up into the moment that the Capitol protest turned into the insurrection.
Well, sticking with the Fox News host for just another minute, because there's a lot more in what Meadows has provided so far before he stopped cooperating with the committee. Not only were those Fox News hosts deflecting on the night of January 6th, but the very lies about fraud in the election, they were happily trumpeting between November and January.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I don't have much sympathy for this point of view that says, oh, these texts vindicate the Fox News hosts because they were trying to intervene against the insurrection. What the reality is a bit more like an analogy of an arsonist who lights a house on fire. And as it starts to spread down the block and starts to threaten their own house, you know, their own legacy, as they put it, Laura Ingraham says, this hurts all of us. As the fire spreads towards them, that's when they start to text and say, you need to put it out. And so, you know, I think this is something where they fanned the flames. They were happy to have this lie spread like wildfire throughout American politics. And only when it started to look bad for them did they raise the alarm and actually say, you need to do something about this, get the fire brigade and put it out.
So we're taking a look at what the House Select Committee has released to the public so far today, not because of, you know, what it helps us understand Trump did or didn't do on January 6th itself, but what it reveals more deeply, especially in the run-up to January 6th, about who was involved in within the Trump administration and then in the near orbit around it, right? And what kinds of ideas they were considering, and what that can shed light on how close this country actually did come to, I don't know, would you call it a coup?
Well, I think, you know, political science is a very specific definition of a coup, but for the purposes of communicating what happened to a non-niche audience, I think it's an effective term. I think what we have to think about is the blind spots that we have when things happen in our own politics that we wouldn't have if they happened abroad. I mean, if you had a president of places where I've done field work, like, you know, Thailand or Madagascar or Ivory Coast, who for months said he would not accept the results of the election, then rejected them, then made false claims about fraud, then picked up the phone, called election officials and told them to find votes, then encouraged people to storm the Capitol or at least go to the Capitol and protest, and then a political movement voted to decertify an election, you wouldn't hesitate to call that authoritarianism. You wouldn't hesitate to call that an attack on democracy. And yet, for some reason, when it happens in our own political system, people think, oh, well, this we can't use these terms. These terms are for the rest of the world. No, they're not. It happened in the United States. And we have to own up to that fact and change our politics to recognize the assault that's happened and is still happening, or it's going to be too late.
Well, let's talk about some of the documents that Mark Meadows turned over to the committee that give us a little more insight on what happened before the 6th of January. There is one document, a 38-page PowerPoint that made quite a splash in the media late last week. I mentioned it a little bit beforehand. This PowerPoint Meadows received in his email. Doesn't seem like that he acted on it. Also doesn't seem to think that it was a huge problem because he gamely handed it over to the committee. But in this document, the PowerPoint suggests other things that former President Trump could do to stay in power. One being declare all electronic voting invalid across the nation. I don't know what would come of a declaration like that. But two, and this is something I guess a president could do, is declare a national emergency in order to somehow stay in power. What did you think when you saw those suggestions?
Well, I thought something that I've been worried about for quite a long time, which is that there's a disconnect between what Trump is saying publicly and how those words are taken by people who are observing it. A lot of people just say, oh, it's just Trump being Trump. He'll say he'll reject the election results. He'll only accept them if he wins. He says he won't ever concede. Oh, it's just, you know, he's just Donald Trump. But behind the scenes, people in positions of authority and power with, you know, legal control over the United States government were trying to find ways to install a person who lost an election into the White House. I mean, you know, I've been baffled how this has been just sort of swept under the rug by half of the political establishment in the country, when it's very, very clear that regardless of actually what happened on January 6th, the highest levels of government were having discussions about how to maintain power despite losing an election. And whether you go through the political science definition of coup, you know, involving the military or not, that's a coup in the sort of clear sense of what we try to convey by that term, keeping somebody in power who has lost an election. And that's what they were trying to do. I mean, I think this is something that we just have to keep hammering this point over and over. It's not breaking news. There's not, you know, always the shiny thing to chase. This fact is the central fact in American politics right now. And it's something that I think we cannot move on from, because similar machinations will be ongoing heading into our next round of elections.
Well, we have the threads coming together now, right? There's the from the moment of the election, of voting ending on November, Donald Trump and his supporters putting out falsehood after falsehood about the trustworthiness of the actual election itself. We know about the phone call, for example, that then-President Trump made to Raffensperger in Georgia about asking him to find 11,000 votes. We know of a sort of a legal advisor to Donald Trump suggesting that Vice President Mike Pence could just remove slates of electors that they objected to and kind of change how the vice president certifies, electoral votes. And now we know more about what even members of Congress were considering in terms of trying to stop the certification of the electors. All that then coming to a head on January 6th with the ransacking of the Capitol. So when we come back, we'll take more of a scalpel to the information that's been slowly coming out of the House Select Committee. So, Professor Kloth, stand by. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at what information has been coming out from the House Select Committee that's investigating the attack on the Capitol that happened on January 6th of this year. Some of what's been coming out are text messages that were sent to former Chief of Staff, White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, on the day of the insurrection. For example, there's this one that Meadows received from Donald Trump Jr., the former president's son. And the text is read by Representative Liz Cheney.
Quote, "We need an Oval Office address. He has to lead now. It has gone too far and gotten out of hand." End quote.
We don't know if Donald Trump Jr. sent a similar message to his own father. But in February, a month after the insurrection, on Fox News, Trump Jr. defended the speech his father did give that day, the one earlier on January 6th, on the ellipse that came before the breach of the Capitol.
If you were to take his speech and compare it to literally any stump speech, you would see absolutely no deviation. But again, because the Democrats have the media in their pocket carrying whatever message, they can go on with impeachment part deux.
Donald Trump Jr. in February. I'm joined today by Brian Kloss. He's professor of global politics at University College London and author of Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. And joining us now is Quinta Jurecic, a fellow at the Brookings Institution and senior editor at the Lawfare blog. Quinta Jurecic, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So I'd love to just hear a little bit from you about your response to these text messages, first of all. Then we'll dive a little deeper into other documents that the committee has revealed to the public. But what do you see in the text messages that were sent to Meadows, not just on January 6th, but even in the days preceding it?
I think reading the text messages, I had pretty much the same reaction as Brian. You know, they don't necessarily raise my baseline level of alarm about what was happening on January 6th and in the weeks and months preceding. But that's only because my baseline was already so high. We already knew, you know, that the White House and Trump's associates outside the White House were pulling every lever they could, trying everything they could think of in order to overturn the election and keep Trump in power, despite the fact that a majority of American voters selected Joe Biden as the president. That is deeply, profoundly concerning. These text messages, I think, add important detail to that story. They add color. I think they're sort of immediately arresting in a way that is maybe good insofar as it redirects public attention to just how dire the situation was and is a year later, when maybe memories have faded a little bit. But I don't think they substantially change the picture of what happened.
Well, there's also the issue that it seems that Mark Meadows had another phone, which apparently has another 1,000+ messages on it that he says he has turned over to his service provider. I don't know if the committee has that phone yet, or if not, what could they do to obtain it?
Well, I'm not aware of the other phone, so that may be a new development as far as I'm concerned. But the committee has been getting information in a couple of different ways. So one way is that they've been going direct to the source, and you see this in the case of Meadows, where they subpoenaed information directly from him, and he did hand over a big tranche of emails and text messages, as we're seeing because we're discussing them, before he stopped cooperating the other week. Then the other way that they've been getting information is, as you mentioned, they've been going to the service providers and asking companies like Verizon, AT&T, to hand over information about the communications that took place. So conceivably, you know, even if Meadows doesn't want to hand over this material, the committee could go to his service provider and submit a formal legal request to have that information passed to them.
And would you recommend that they do that?
Well, I wouldn't presume to give them legal advice, but I would not be surprised if they were thinking about it.
Well, so the reporting on this other phone, the New York Times reported on it. Let me just get the right date for everybody because they're going to ask me about it, from a Time story on December 10th, where they say that Mr. Meadows informed the committee that he had turned in the cell phone he used on January 6th to his service provider and that he was withholding some 1,000 text messages connected with that device. Brian Kloss, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, it's crucially important for record keeping, for accountability, that all of these things get turned over to the committee. And I think we need to have a full picture. But I think we also have to understand that we don't need those texts to understand what happened. And I think that what's important, and I think I agree completely with Quinta, which she just said, is that this is a situation that requires public attention to be brought back to January 6th, the events around it, and the ongoing attempts to subvert democracy in America. And that's where these text messages are so important, because the news is built around breaking information. Mm-hmm. So if you have this one big fact that comes out, like exactly what we know happened, Trump incited this movement that then tried to overturn an election, that's hard to convey to people who are reading the news every single day. You just can't keep writing the same story. So what the January 6th committee, I think if they're trying to play this in a smart way, what they'll do is they'll continually drip this information out so that it maintains primacy in the news cycle heading up towards the anniversary. And I expect we're going to get more revelations as a result of that.
Okay. So as I said a little earlier, I want to take something of a proverbial scalpel to some of this other information. So coming back to that PowerPoint, that 38-page PowerPoint. Now, Meadows handed that over. It was in his emails to the committee. Didn't seem to act on anything in that PowerPoint. Not even sure he read it. We don't know. But there's more to its existence than that, because a version of it, yes, was sort of floating around the internet before January. So one could argue that it was already out there amongst circles of supporters of former President Trump. But there has been some interesting reporting that's come out recently about it, that the version that was sent to Meadows was written by a man named Phil Waldron. And a tip of the hat to the New York Times and The Atlantic for their reporting. Waldron's a retired Army colonel, very influential voice in challenging the results of the election. And he had circulated the document. It's called Election Fraud, Foreign Interference, and Options for January 6th. Okay, so be that as it may. But what's more interesting to me is that the Times reports that on January 4th, members of Waldron's team spoke to a group of senators in Washington and gave them the document. And then as well, the following day on January 5th, Waldron says he personally briefed a small group of House members, also gave them the document. And prior to that, Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, has frequently cited Waldron as a source of information for his legal campaign. So what does that very close connection with House and Senate members and Rudy Giuliani himself tell you, if anything, Quinta Jurecic?
We've known for a while that there were some pretty crazy theories circulating among Trump's inner circle, both in his campaign and within the White House. The first thing that I thought when I saw this PowerPoint had been in Meadows' email was there was reporting a while ago that Meadows, I think, had emailed members of the Justice Department encouraging them to look into the conspiracy theory known as Italygate, which, frankly, I don't really understand, but involves something to do with Italian satellites somehow changing their results of the election. It's obviously not true. So this PowerPoint is deeply disturbing, don't get me wrong. And I think in that way, it's sort of a piece with the picture that we had about what different associates of Trump were thinking, where their heads were at what sorts of wild theories they had about, you know, various ways that the election had been rigged. I mean, if you look at the PowerPoint, it's frankly completely incomprehensible. And the things that they were willing to try in order to really push the envelope to get Trump to stay in office. And I should say, I think it's important to understand, you know, the legal mechanisms that you've been mentioning. So, for example, declaring a national emergency, that is not actually something that could have helped Trump stay in office. I think declaring a national emergency sounds very alarming. But what it actually refers to is the president using a power that was delegated to him by Congress under the National Emergencies Act. And it kind of, it unlocks other statutory authority. So, you know, the president can do certain things that he wouldn't be able to do under normal circumstances. Your listeners might remember this is how Trump unlocked funding and military assistance in his efforts to build a wall on the southern border. But there's no statutory authority to overturn the results of the election. And the 20th Amendment says very clearly that the president's term ends on January 20th. So when I looked at the PowerPoint, what I saw was a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of falsehoods, and a lot of ideas about how Trump could use his authorities that are just not connected to reality. That doesn't mean that, you know, the situation couldn't have been very bad if Trump tried to do that. But I do think it's important to understand that, you know, Trump's associates hadn't figured out some sort of magical legal loophole that would have allowed Trump to stay in power. He would have been doing that completely extra legally.
So point well taken on that in terms of the fantastical nature of some of the suggestions in the PowerPoint. I completely hear you on that. But Professor Kloss, let me turn back to you on this. Even as Quinta rightly describes what's legal and what's extra legal, I see the existence of not only just the PowerPoint itself, but the fact that Phil Waldron, who wrote it, had access and admits it openly to members of Congress, both in the Senate and the House, in the days before January 6th, as part and parcel of, we never thought they would do it before, but they did. Right? Like, there's a time in America where we wouldn't imagine the president of the United States calling up the secretary of state of another state and just asking him to also magically find 11,000 votes. There's a time in the United States where we never thought that a legal advisor would be standing next to the president's attorney in the Oval Office and forcefully say, let's have the vice president stop the electoral count. You know, there's a time where after Congress got ransacked that we wouldn't have imagined that members of Congress would come back in the wee hours of the morning and still try to advance the lie that animated the very people who had just ransacked Congress. I mean, how much more can the water slowly boil before this frog of American democracy is ready to jump out of the pot?
Yeah, you know, the PowerPoint is interesting in this regard because of the way that pro-Trump commentators tried to spin the events of January 6th. I point to the clip you had a second ago about Sean Hannity saying, oh, you know, there were bad actors who had infiltrated and they're always on the fringe and these aren't actually the real Trump supporters. What we're finding out is that the bad actors are central to the story of who's in the White House, who's around the White House, who's in Congress. These people had access. They were speaking in the ears of legal experts, of, you know, senators and House members who were voting to overturn the election. They were not fringe lunatics. They were people who may have had lunatic conspiracy theories, but they actually had power. They had access. And I think that's so important. And I think it's also important to understand that the text and the story of January 6th is not trying to recreate something from the past. It's trying to understand something that's ongoing. This dynamic still exists, right? I mean, the person who was behind writing the PowerPoint, the colonel that you just mentioned, Phil Waldron, he's being invited to speak to local and state Republican groups currently. This is not some has-been. He's not been discredited. He's just been shuffled away from the White House to other elements of the Republican Party. And so this shift in Republican Party politics towards an unapologetic embrace of tactics that aim to subvert elections in the United States is not a historical story. It's an ongoing and future story that we have to take extraordinarily seriously to protect elections going into 2022 and 2024.
You know, Quinta Jurecic, this makes me think about the same challenge that comes when, you know, with a presidential impeachment, and we just had two in the past couple of years, that you're exactly right, that there are actions that are either legal or extra legal, but an impeachment is inherently a political process. I wonder if that same tension is here with the committee's investigation, right? Because would you call it a political process? Because it's coming out of Congress. And does that put it not at odds, but in terms of at tension with what could be accomplished to defend American democracy legally?
I think it's important to contextualize the investigation as an investigation by Congress,
which,
as you say, is, of course, a political branch of government. But it's symbolically important to see Congress itself engaging in this kind of investigation for two reasons, I'd argue. First is that, of course, the January 6th insurrection was an attack on Congress. And so I think it's sort of symbolically important as a matter of showing the strength of American democracy to show that Congress is capable of standing up for itself. And to take a step back, I think that's also important insofar as the investigation shows Congress asserting itself after the Trump presidency, during which Trump repeatedly was able to deny information to Congress, prevent it from getting information, delay. And so if the committee is able to really put together some findings and get the information that it needs, which it seems like it is, that will be a really powerful statement about the committee's ability to investigate the executive branch. So that, I think, all lends to me to the power of what is happening right now with the January 6th committee. Mm. And it is political for the reasons that you say, but I don't think political has to mean partisan. Mm. And what I mean by that is that, you know, a congressional investigation is not the same thing as a legal investigation by the Justice Department where a prosecution could result at the end of it. The goal of what the committee is doing here is to find information, perhaps put together a report, and they've talked about putting together some recommendations for legislation to, say, address the Electoral Count Act, which was the statute under which the certification of the electoral vote by Congress was taking place that Trump sought to disrupt, or perhaps address obstruction of justice statutes to make clear that conduct like Trump was doing, you know, twisting the arm of state election officials, would be outlawed. And so that is important, and I think it's crucial to defending American democracy, even if it doesn't result in a prosecution.
Okay, so what the committee could recommend as and when it does ultimately put out a report, I want to explore that more with both of you when we come back from a quick break. So we're taking a close look today at the House Select Committee investigating January 6th, the information that it has gleaned so far and some of it which it's putting out into the public. I'm joined by Quinta Jurecic and Brian Kloss. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a little preview of what we're going to be talking about on the show tomorrow. We're going to be talking about how or what the experience is for some people struggling with opioid addiction, what they actually feel when they're taking opioids, because there's a growing body of research that says for some people struggling with addiction, taking opioids, the physical and emotional experience they get, the folks get, is one that feels a lot like love. And so we want to hear your story. If you have struggled with opioid addiction, when you were getting high, what did that actually feel like? Viscerally, emotionally, what did it feel like when you took those drugs? And if you're in recovery, what have you found in your life, or what did you find necessary to build into your life that replaced that feeling, maybe even of love, that using opioids gave you? So we want to hear your story. That's 617-353-0683. That's our voicemail line. It's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are taking a close look at what's been revealed so far, especially in the last week or so, from the House Select Committee that's investigating the January 6th attack on Congress. And I'm joined today by Brian Kloss. He's a professor of global politics at University College London and author of Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. Quinta Jurecic is also with us as well, a fellow at the Brookings Institution and senior editor at the truly excellent Lawfare blog. I'm just going to come out and say it. I'm a Lawfare addict, Quinta. But let me just ask you, both of you, about the functioning of the committee itself. Because in a sense, in the last segment, the way we were talking about the committee's work, it put me in mind of the 9/11 Commission, right? The 9/11 Commission's job was to go back and find as exhaustively as possible every last piece of evidence that would help the nation understand how planes flew into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and in Shanksville, Pennsylvania on 9/11/2001. But that was an act that had happened, and the commission was charged with looking back. The threats to democracy that were revealed on January 6th are ongoing. So how does that affect sort of the pace that the commission ought to be working at, how frequently they should be revealing what information they have, just sort of the relationship the commission needs to have to the public, Quinta? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, first, thank you for your kind words about Lawfare. We really appreciate it. And second, it's a good point. And there are other distinguishing factors as well. I mean, what first comes to mind is that the 9/11 Commission had years. The January 6th committee started its work in July 2021. And Chairman Benny Thompson has said that he wants to wrap up the committee's work by this spring of 2022. Even if they push that deadline, assuming, as it seems is probably the case, that the Republican Party takes control of the House after the midterms, the committee will have to end its work by January of 2023. So the clock is really ticking on getting information out there. I think another factor also is that, you know, unlike in the case of 9/11, where this was really a cross-party, you know, unified effort to get to the bottom of what happened, and there was widespread American acknowledgement that, you know, 9/11 had occurred and that it was a terrible tragedy, here we're in a situation where the majority of the Republican Party is denying that January 6th, you know, was committed by Trump supporters, or if it was committed, that it was good that it had taken place. So the political contentiousness is really, really something new. And I think that we might see how that changes how the committee thinks about its work and how it goes about presenting its results. But to go to your question about, you know, how they're going to put forward what they find, I do think that because the timeline is so short, you know, it makes sense that we may be seeing these sort of drip, drip, drips of information, the text messages, the PowerPoints, and that we should expect to see, you know, some sort of report in the spring. Liz Cheney, the ranking Republican member on the committee, has said that the committee plans to hold multiple weeks of hearings in the new year. So I'll be looking out for that.
So, Brian Kloss, you know, the accelerating the drip, drip, drip of information, would you advise the committee to do that? Because the long sort of gaps, the long silences, in terms of public silences of the committee, serve to sort of put it on the back foot a little bit in comparison to the never-ending fire hose of propagandic disinformation about the 2020 election that's out there through various media outlets and social media. In a sense, like, doesn't fighting that fire require, you know, the cold, hard facts of information that the committee could or should be putting out more often?
Yeah, I think they need to make it much more urgent and much more central as a part of messaging for pro-democracy forces, which are disproportionately Democratic voices at the moment. But of course, you have Liz Cheney and so on from the Republican side. You know, I think we have a cognitive bias as humans to think about contentious issues in the context of how urgently they're being dealt with. So if one side is saying this is an emergency, this was an attack on our democracy, and the other side is saying, you know, it was just tourists in the Capitol, as one Republican congressman once portrayed it. And then you have a very, very slow moving commission. People will point to that as evidence that it's not actually an emergency, which is unfortunate because it is. And so, you know, I think it's really important that this gets elevated, not just that the committee ends up producing news by releasing information, documents, and texts. But I am, you know, baffled why there haven't been more primetime press conferences from the White House, for example, explaining this in clear language, elevating it to the importance of a national emergency. Because as Quintus said, you know, the difference between 9/11 and January 6th is that after 9/11, everybody agreed it was an emergency and everybody was working overtime to prevent the next one. In this instance, we have, you know, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, a House member on the Republican side, visited people who were convicted and detained in jail and portrayed them as sort of martyrs almost. And so, you know, I think this divide in the country makes it that much more important that the clarity of language, the description of, look, here's what happened. There was a clear attempt to try to put somebody into the presidency who lost the election. That is not something that's Democratic or Republican. That's something that's anti-democracy. It's authoritarian. And we have to fix that before we get to the next elections. And I think that's the messaging that I've been waiting to hear in a much more elevated primetime style address from the White House.
But of course, as Quinta just rightly noted, there's this more than critical mass of Americans who actually would disagree with the very first part of the statement you just made. They don't believe he lost. And that gap, that belief gap right there, is exactly why, you know, maybe 9/11, someone else did that to us, but we're damaging our own democracy by ourselves and through just competing realities, Professor Claus. I mean, how do you overcome that?
Yeah, so it's a great question because you're right. I mean, the people who are watching Fox News or, you know, the more extreme propagandistic outlets like OAN or Newsmax may not have even heard about these text messages, right? The Fox covered them, I believe, 24 hours after they were released, whereas the sort of normal media was grappling with this important fact right away, as you should. And so, you know, I think the point is that you need to stop trying to determine how to portray or cover an issue based on people who are already deluded. You just have to go after truth and democracy. Those are the sort of guiding principles of responsible journalists and responsible political communicators in the United States. Now, we have to contend with the fact that some people won't hear that, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't try. It means that you should try even harder to make this so prominent that you can't ignore it. And I think that's the level of sort of discourse that's been missing, where people who are paying attention to the back and forth of daily politics, they know all about this stuff, especially if they're, you know, listening to or watching mainstream responsible reporting. But people who don't care or simply are self-selecting into these partisan echo chambers on the political right that are effectively apologists for January 6th, those people need to be made aware of these facts. And the only way to do that I'm aware of is to have things like a presidential address that talks about the severity of the crisis. So that's why I argue in favor of it, because I think it's not cutting through to enough people that this is actually a Democratic emergency.
You know, Quinta Jurecic, every time we do a show regarding January 6th, I get emails from public radio listeners who say, I don't care. There's too many other things in life I'm dealing with now. I can still vote. It's fine. Nobody cares. Like these are people who listen to this show regularly. I think that sentiment is deeper than you know, maybe the three of us want to believe. I mean, what do we do with that as the committee is trying to, you know, uncover information that ostensibly ought to make every American care?
I think it's a really hard problem, and I wish I knew the solution to it. It reminds me a lot of the similar dynamics that I think we saw during the Mueller investigation and then the first impeachment regarding Trump's efforts to pressure Ukraine to provide negative information on Joe Biden, where on the one hand, I would argue as someone who was watching and covering those events that they were crucially important to the strength of American democracy and to the political system's ability to hold the president accountable for abuse of his office. On the other hand, you know, you would often see polls that came out during the Mueller investigation where people would say, you know, this is the fifth, sixth, ninth, tenth most important thing on my list. You know, that the most important thing that they cared about politically was healthcare or other kitchen table issues. So I'm not a political messaging consultant. I wish that they could help solve this problem for us. It does strike me, as Brian says, that I think there are two different issues here. One is the issue of, can we speak the truth and be loud and as clear as possible about what happened, the danger of what happened, and the risks of it happening again? And then there's the question of how do we best communicate that to the widest amount of people, including those who have a lot on their plate and aren't thinking about it right now, and even those who are just outright hostile. And on the latter group of people, I really don't know. Yeah. I think it's sort of the question right now. Yeah.
Well, there's something else you said a little earlier that I don't want it to get buried too much here. You said that there's an opportunity here through perhaps the committee itself to take a look at strengthening actual instruments of democracy, certain statutes, et cetera. I was wondering if you had more thoughts on that, on what you would actually like them to take a closer look at and recommend that legislatively be improved and strengthened.
Absolutely. So the committee has given us some hints of what they're thinking about in filings that they've put forward in litigation. And we know that near the top of their list, because they've mentioned it a couple times, is, as I mentioned, reforming the Electoral Count Act. So this is the legislation that sets out the procedures through which the electoral vote is certified, which is what the insurrectionists were attempting to disrupt and overturn on January 6th itself. I don't believe that the committee has put out details yet of what they want amended, but there's been a lot of discussion around within activists, academics, legal scholars working on pro-democracy issues, that this is something that needs to be reformed, essentially to get rid of the kinds of loopholes that were available that you saw sketched out in that PowerPoint to allow, you know, the vice president to try some kind of chicanery and turn the whole thing on its head. I think that it's pretty clear after the experience of January 6th that is something that it would be worth looking at seriously. The other thing that I mentioned, and again, I think the committee has mentioned this in its filings in court, is looking at the obstruction of justice statutes. And what I mean by that is that, and again, listeners might recall this from the Mueller investigation, there's some confusion over whether or not what Trump did in terms of twisting arms, trying to get people to drop investigations, start investigations, whether that is sort of cleanly fits under the obstruction of justice statutes. And so there are tweaks that Congress could make to make that extra clear, with the idea that, you know, if another president, perhaps Trump in office again, tried this again, it would be much more obvious that it would be criminally chargeable. So hopefully that would serve as a deterrent, and it would make it a lot easier to actually charge and prosecute somebody who tried that. I know that there are a lot of other things that are on the table as well. The committee has, I think, put out a long list of potential reforms, but those are some of the ones that they've prominently mentioned.
Okay, so potentially actionable recommendations if the committee chooses to make them. Look, we've just got about 2 minutes left, and Brian Kloss, I want to close with you because January 6th wasn't the end of anything. For some people, it was very much the beginning. You know, you've mentioned this before. There are now people who participated in the insurrection, physically participated in on that day, January 6th, who are now helping to run elections in their home state. There's a gentleman that's been reported on named Stephen Lindemuth in Pennsylvania, who 3 days after January 6th put on Facebook that he was there to stand for the truth to be heard. And now he ran for and won in a race to be a judge of elections in his local Pennsylvania town. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think that's it's the ongoing threat to our democratic system, our democratic way of life. There is a systematic attempt to turn elections into a battleground for which it doesn't matter whether you win more votes than your opponent. It matters whether there's somebody in a position of power who can then put their thumb on the scale and ensure that you get seated if you're a Republican, even if you lost. And I think, you know, we have to be really, really clear about that. This is something where the attempts are ongoing. And I think to close with that big picture that Quince is talking about, I couldn't agree more that there need to be consequences to this, because regardless of what is legal or is not legal now, we have to ask ourselves a question. Do we want to live in a society in which a president or the people around him can pressure election officials, can pick up the phone and bully people into trying to find votes without consequence? I think most of us would agree that the answer is no, but I think that, you know, unfortunately, we're finding out that that's going to have to be a battle that we fight. It's not going to happen automatically, and unless we fight that battle, we're in real trouble heading into our next round of elections.
And it's coast to coast, because now we have people who believe former President Trump's false claim that the election was stolen from him running election systems in municipalities and various places. I mean, someone in Pennsylvania said, "I'm hoping that we don't have any constitutional crises in our neck of the woods, but things are a bit scary." Well, Brian Kloss and Quinta Jurecic, thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make. That's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.